someone once said, you know, you can divide man's work into a calling like a priest, a profession like a doctor, a career where you go from step to step to step, moving up a ladder, or just a job where you walk in every day and sort of punch a ticket. I find the military is someplace between the calling and the profession. You know, it's something you're identified with, you have a title, like a doctor has a title, and everybody calls you that, and yet you also have to have this inner drive of service.
General Norman Schwarzkopf's service to the United States and to the men and women who served under him was legendary. Most people hadn't heard of him before Operation Desert Storm, now also known as the First Gulf War. And soon after that, he retired from the military. But during the early 1990s, General Schwarzkopf was America's most revered war hero. He not only vanquished Saddam Hussein's Revolutionary Guard, who had invaded Kuwait, he also managed to vanquish a malaise that had hung over the United States since the Vietnam War.
As Commander-in-Chief, I can report to you our armed forces fought with honor and valor. And as President, I can report to the nation, aggression is defeated, the war is over.
With a lightning-fast and thunderous win, the American military was back in the eyes and the hearts of its people. This episode features an interview with Norman Schwarzkopf from 1992, a year after his victory in Kuwait. I think of it as a time capsule from a brief era of triumph and hope about the Middle East. But it's also the story of one man and the lessons he learned along the way to earning 4 stars across his shoulder.
West Point gave us a creed to live by, duty, honor, country. And not everybody that graduates from West Point, of course, lives by that creed for their entire life, but I have. I mean, it just became a way of life for me.
This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
I once said to someone, I said, you know, man does not get to write his own epitaph, but if I were to write mine, it would say the following. He loved his family and he loved his troops and they loved him. Period.
These are the words that do appear, more or less, on Norman Schwarzkopf's gravestone at West Point Cemetery. The general died in 2012 at the age of 78, 20 years after this interview. But the inscription is not quite as short and sweet as he envisioned. It also includes a brief history of his 39 years in the military, including his service in Vietnam and his role as commander of the coalition forces in Operation Desert Storm, the one that made him a household name in America and in much of the world. His command in the Persian Gulf was a fitting end to his military career. He spent part of his childhood in Tehran. Interviewer Gail Eichenthal asked whether he felt any sense of destiny about his return to the Gulf.
12 years old, I went to Tehran to join my father. He had gone over there in 1942 and was there, gone from home for 4 years. And I went over to join him in 1946 after the war was over and lived in Iran for a year. I don't know about a sense of destiny in the Middle East. When you're in the military service, everybody in the military service prepares themselves for what they hope will never come. And you see a succession of people enter the military service and leave, and some of them, you know, their time comes at when they're much lower ranking than I was. It just happened that in my case, three different times I was required to go off to war, and the last time was when I was a 4-star general, and therefore it fell to my lot to be the leader.
But before we plow ahead, a little more about General Schwarzkopf's father, who was also a general. Because yes, as it is in so many military families, the father's path greatly influences the son's. But also because there's a wild bit of family history here we can't leave out. Between serving in World War I and World War II, the elder Schwarzkopf moved home to El Paso to guard the U.S.-Mexican border. He was part of the cavalry. But then his father became completely crippled.
In a wheelchair from arthritis to deformis. And in those days, a captain in the Army didn't make any money at all. And my dad was an only child, so he became the sole support of his parents. So he had to leave the military.
And moved to the East Coast, where he got a job organizing the 1st New Jersey State Police Force, and at 27 years old, became their first superintendent. And why is that interesting? Because it was in that capacity that he became the lead investigator in the 1932 Lindbergh baby kidnapping. As soon as he was called to the Lindbergh home, he set up a police command in the garage. Charles Lindbergh was a powerful force, though, and ran roughshod over Chief Schwarzkopf, insisting that police stay away from the ransom drop. Of course, we know the end of that story. Baby Charlie was already dead by then and was eventually found in a shallow grave 4 miles from the house. It was Schwarzkopf who inspected the grave and first saw the tiny body. He had a theory of how Charlie was kidnapped and killed, and he tested it by reenacting the crime in great detail. In the end, Schwarzkopf Sr. led an investigation worthy of Sherlock Holmes, and the murderer was caught and executed. Which leads us to another bit of intrigue, albeit a much more innocent one, and that is the mystery behind the H in the names of both Schwarzkopf men, father and son.
My dad's name was Herbert Norman Schwarzkopf. He hated the name Herbert. And so he had long since adopted H. Norman, but he went to West Point. And when he entered West Point, he was in the class of 1917. So when he entered West Point in 1913, all military forms, if you know anything about them, say first name, middle initial. I guess most forms do, bureaucratic forms. So my father filled it out, H. Norman, and they threw it back at him and said, don't you know anything? It says first name, middle initial. And so he had to fill it out Herbert N. And every record he ever had in his entire life was had Herbert N. on it, and he hated it. So when I was born, my dad had already decided I was going to West Point. I mean, that was all it was to it. This boy's going to West Point. And he wasn't going to let it happen to me, so I was baptized H. Norman. So I have a first initial only is what I have.
To paint a better portrait of H. Norman Schwarzkopf, journalist Gail Eichenthal wanted to know during this interview what kind of kid the general had been, what he liked to read, Lassie, Jack London, The Iliad and the Odyssey, even Das Kapital, whether he was an athlete, soccer and tennis in high school, but not college, and how he fared in school.
When I was a younger student, I was one of these students that was forever getting these comments on his report card that said he is not working to his potential. He can do much better than what he is doing. I went overseas, and overseas I was more interested in learning by seeing and feeling and hearing and experiencing and that sort of thing. And amazingly enough, I came back to the United States and was a straight-A student from there on out. I mean, something clicked somewhere along the way, and I graduated valedictorian of my class in high school, and I was top 10% of my class at West Point without very much work, and got a master's degree in guided missile engineering from USC. Something turned on.
It's hard to know when it happened exactly. It may have started in Iran, or in Switzerland, where they moved next for a year, or in Frankfurt, when his dad was reassigned to Germany. There was also the year in Heidelberg, and one in Rome, too.
There's no question about the fact that the teenage years that I spent abroad had a tremendous impact upon my entire life from that time forth. I mean, I got to know people of so many different nationalities, of so many different cultures, of so many different ethnic backgrounds, and in meeting all of these people of so many different makeups was a wonderful education for me. It taught me that there's more than one way to look at a problem, and they all may be right. You see, so it gave me a certain tolerance, I guess, or not even a tolerance. Maybe tolerance isn't the right word, because tolerance implies that there's intolerance before it. And it's not that, but it just gave me an appreciation for people. Judge them as you find them. Never prejudge anybody based upon any of those things that sometimes people are prejudged. And that's lived with me for the rest of my life. And it gave me the ability to be flexible, to get along with people of all different nationalities.
That ability certainly came in handy when he had to lead a coalition force of 39 countries into Kuwait to rout out the Iraqi Revolutionary Guard. But we will get to that. Earlier on in life, Norman Schwarzkopf wasn't even sure he would stick it out in the military.
No, I'll be very honest with you. I always knew I was going to go to West Point. My dad wanted it very much for me. And you know, those were the days when your father wanted something for you, you as a dutiful son did what your father asked. And I liked it. I liked the structured environment of military school. So I knew I was going to go to West Point. When you graduated in West Point in those days, you had a three-year obligation. So the day I graduated in West Point, I decided, okay, I have a three-year obligation. I'm going to go out and do the best I can for those 3 years. Then I'll make up my mind whether I'm going to stay in the service. And even years later, I would tell young officers, you know, I never made up my mind that I definitely was going to stay in the military. I always made up my mind not to get out yet. You know, there was always some new adventure over the horizon, and I would move into that new adventure and say, well, let's see where this leads, and maybe at the end of that, I will get out. And then, you know, the adventures kept coming, and I stayed.
His father lived just long enough to see him graduate from West Point.
And I can honestly say that that was probably the proudest day of his life, I think. But he died shortly thereafter, so he never saw his son really go beyond the rank of lieutenant. When I graduated, I could have gone into any branch of the service I wanted to. I've got to tell you, my father was appalled that I went in the infantry. I mean, absolutely appalled that I picked the infantry. I think he thought I was going to pick the Corps of Engineers or you know, go into the Air Force High Tech or something. In those days, when you graduated from West Point, there was no Air Force Academy, so 20% of the class could go in the Air Force if they wanted to. And when I picked the infantry, I tell you what, he never did really understand that.
But it fit with the vision Schwarzkopf had for himself.
I will confess to you that, and there's a lesson here someplace, I did not come into the Army to be a lieutenant or a captain or a major. I always thought I was going to be a general. At least I intended to be a general. You know, it's if I started pumping gas, I would want to be the CEO of Shell Oil, okay? So I always aimed high.
What he could not have envisioned, he said, was where the military and geopolitical events would take him.
I can tell you one thing. When I graduated from West Point in 1956, if anybody had come to me and said, General, where do you expect, or Lieutenant, had said, Lieutenant, where do you expect to fight your wars? I doubt very seriously if I would have said, oh, well, it's very clear, I'm going to fight in Vietnam, Grenada, and Iraq. Of course not.
For all the war that Norman Schwarzkopf saw in his life and all the battles he waged, he said he was anything but a hawk.
I don't know of many generals that are warmongers. There may have been in the past, but in the modern generals that I know are just the opposite. I mean, they will go to extreme steps to avoid war because they know just how bad it is. Let's face it, there's not a general out there today who didn't live through Vietnam, didn't go through the Vietnam experience. In my case, I happened to go through Vietnam experience twice and also Grenada. And so we know the horrors of war, and I think that probably you will find that that we are greater pacifists than most people you would meet. On the other hand, when the time comes when you must go to war, I think we also understand the way to get it over as quickly is to do it as quickly as possible, to bring all of your power to bear and get the darn thing over. And that's another way you save lives. I mean, if war is inevitable and you're going to have to fight it, then the smart way to fight it is to use everything you have, get it over with. Don't let it get long and drawn out. That's why we lost 57,000 people in Vietnam, because because that war just dragged on and on and on, and piecemeal commitments and fighting under all sorts of restrictions and that sort of thing. That's not the way to fight a war.
General Schwarzkopf did two tours in Vietnam. He had been in grad school getting a master's degree so that he could return to West Point to teach engineering mechanics. But more and more Army officers were being sent to Vietnam as advisors, and so duty called to him.
I was an infantryman. I was not an instructor. I had graduated from West Point to be an infantryman, and I really felt that that's where I belong. So I volunteered to go to Vietnam, and as luck would have it, I got to go that time. I had a terrific experience over there, very rewarding, very self-fulfilling, and probably one of the most self-fulfilling experiences I've ever had, because there was no gain in it for me at all. I mean, I was making tremendous sacrifice for no personal gain, and that somehow can be one of the most self-fulfilling experiences you ever have. I went back to West Point to finish my teaching career and went to Fort Leavenworth and had gotten married in the meantime, but the war was still going on, and I knew that I had learned a great deal on my first tour, and I felt that perhaps because I had learned so much that I could save some lives by going back the second time. So I volunteered to go back the second time and spent a year over there again.
The second tour in 1970 would prove to be more dramatic than the first, and in the first he'd been awarded 2 Silver Stars and a Purple Heart. But during that second tour, he was given his first field command and lived through 2 haunting incidents. One involved the death of 2 soldiers under his command who were killed by so-called friendly fire from an artillery shell.
It's a terrible thing when it happens, and it's twice as difficult to explain to the troops and 3 times as difficult to explain to the families of the troops. And that was the incident. There was one young man that was killed, an outstanding young man, and his parents never really could reconcile themselves to what had happened. They were quite convinced that there was some kind of a cover-up. We had casualties in this war from our own fire. And now we see the same thing all over again, the agony in the family. This war, it's even tougher because there were so few casualties to begin with that anyone who lost a loved one kind of feels cheated because so few people were lost. Why did it have to be my son or my husband or my father? And you certainly understand that. And then when they find out subsequently that they were killed by the fire of their own side, that makes it doubly hard to live with. It's a tragic, tragic situation. It was a tragic situation in Vietnam, and it's a tragic situation when it happens today.
I gather that you personally felt these losses very deeply.
Yeah, if you lead men in battle, I don't care whether you're a sergeant or a second lieutenant or a 4-star general, they're your people. They're your troops, men and women, I should say. They're your troops. So the loss of every single person that's ever been under my command in battle has always hurt. I mean, even though our losses were so few in the Gulf War, we still suffered losses, and I still grieve for every one of them.
General Schwarzkopf was a big, burly, intimidating figure with a temper that earned him the nickname Stormin' Norman long before he was given command of Operation Desert Storm. But he was famous among his troops for allowing his grief to show too. They were moved by that, and it inspired tremendous morale. He also had a proven track record from Vietnam as someone willing to put his own life on the line to save the lives of his soldiers. He tells that story here. It happened in May of 1970 near the site of the My Lai massacre.
We had moved into a new area where the mines were very, very heavy. And so anytime we would have a mine incident, and we had an awful lot of them when we first moved into the area because it was a very heavily mined area, and my troops weren't mine-wise. They didn't have the moxie at that time that they later on became, you know, the word street smart. Well, they were mine smart after a while. But when we first got there, every time, somebody would hit a mine, I would always fly in if I was in the area in my helicopter, land right there on the ground, you know, put the casualty on the helicopter because that got him back to the hospital about a half an hour quicker than they would ordinarily. But the other reason why was to go around and just talk to the troops because the mines are insidious sort of a thing. They happen. If you're out and you shoot at the enemy and he shoots back at you and you take some casualties, They're not acceptable, but you do understand that at least it was an exchange that caused it to happen. When you're walking along, all of a sudden a mind goes boom, and you see one of your friends killed or lose a leg or something like that, and there's nobody to get even with. I mean, there's no way to retaliate. That tends to fester inside, and so I would go in to try and understand all that. Well, in this one case, we'd had a mine casualty, and I flew in to medevac them, and I was on the ground. And then, of course, we had another mine casualty, and we were right in the middle of a minefield, and I had to do something about it. The soldier was lying on the ground screaming, and I was afraid that he was going to set off more mines, or worse yet, he had a badly broken leg, and I was afraid that he was going to cut the artery in his leg and die. So I had to go over there and settle him down, and there was nobody else to do it, so I had to walk through the minefield to do it. Believe me, it wasn't a heroic act at that time. It was something that somebody had to do, and I was the guy that was, you know, I was the man in charge, so I was the one that had to do it. Heroism is in the eyes of the beholders. It's like beauty. Nobody says on the battlefield, "Well, I think I will now be a hero and go do a heroic act." You don't do that. It's people doing their job.
Whatever his own thought processes and motives, the military certainly saw it as a heroic act and decorated him for it with another Silver Star and another Purple Heart. But when Norman Schwarzkopf returned from Vietnam from both his first and second tours, he didn't exactly receive a hero's welcome.
You have to understand that when the first time I came home from the war, I was confused. Because I had been so intensely involved in this thing called a war, and I came back to the United States, and it was like it wasn't going on. It's 1966. And the only families that were involved in the war were people who had loved ones over there. And nobody else seemed to much even know or care that the war was going on. When I came back in 1970, it was different, because now we were being blamed for the war. You know, the military, who were just doing their duty. Draftees, I mean, kids that had been drafted in the military and sent to war when they came back home were being blamed by the American people for the war. That's intolerable. I mean, that's terrible. But a maturation process came about in the American people, because in the Gulf War, you didn't run into that. I think they finally recognized that, hey, the members of the armed services over there are people who are just doing their duty. They're doing their duty because their country asked them to. They're not the ones that caused the war itself. And we got letters over there from people who would say, look, I may not agree with the decisions that put you there, but by golly, now that you're there, I'm supporting you. You've got my support. And then, of course, when I got home, I've run into, I can't tell you how many thousands of Vietnam veterans that have come over and threw their arms around me and just say, thank you, General, for, you know, you made it all right. You vindicated us. It's amazing, but somehow so many of them feel like that they won in the Gulf War. And so that's good stuff. It's good stuff.
The country was practically high on victory parades at the end of Operation Desert Storm, as if they would bring absolution for the sins of the Vietnam era. And General H. Norman Schwarzkopf, who himself was feted as a conquering hero, made sure his fellow soldiers from the war 20 years earlier reaped the benefit. He even mentioned them in his remarks to Congress after returning from Operation Desert Storm. So how did the mistakes of the Vietnam War influence General Schwarzkopf's battle plans in the Persian Gulf in 1991?
A lot. I mean, both positive and negative. You know, somebody once said you learn more from negative leadership than you do positive leadership. I believe that. I believe that very much. So I was bound and determined that we weren't going to repeat some of the mistakes that we'd made in Vietnam. I was bound and determined that if we were going to go to war, we're going to get it over with. We're going to use our full military might. And I would say to you, I'm very proud and very happy that our country, that our administration, that the president on down, the Secretary of Defense, allowed us to do it that way. War is never the right thing to do. But if you have to fight a war, there is a right way to fight the war. And that's the way that will minimize your casualties, save the lives of the people that are out there fighting. Get it over with as fast as you can.
It could hardly have been a faster war, a six-week air campaign to decimate Saddam Hussein's fighting capabilities, followed by a 100-hour ground offensive. But for all the brilliant tactical plans, the flawless execution, and the formidable drubbing, Schwarzkopf said he had many doubts and plenty of fear. They just come with the job, even when you're a general. Doubts make you plan for every contingency, and fear provides cover.
Listen, anybody who says they're not afraid in war is either a liar or they're crazy. Okay? And there's nothing wrong with fear. I mean, fear is good. Fear will keep you alive in war. Fear keep you alive in business. Okay? Nothing wrong with being afraid at all. And everybody should understand that. And fear tends to cause you to focus. It tends to cause your adrenaline to run. It tends to cause you to do things that you know, perhaps to see things in much, much sharper perspective at that instant. What is bad is when you allow that fear to turn into panic, and you allow that fear to petrify you to the point that you cannot perform your whatever duty you have to do. That's the thing that's wrong with fear. But there's nothing wrong with being afraid. And true courage is not being afraid. True courage is being afraid and going ahead and doing your job anyhow. That's what courage is.
The interviewer wanted to know what General Schwarzkopf learned about leadership over the course of his life that he didn't know when he graduated from West Point.
Wow. What do I know now about leadership that I didn't know when I graduated from West Point? It's not a perfect world. When I graduated from West Point, I saw things very much in shades of black and white. And I've come to understand that, I demanded a great deal of myself then as a young man, in shades of black and white. I mean, you had to do everything right. You couldn't do anything wrong. And that's not what life's all about. How can you not allow yourself mistakes? You're not giving yourself a freedom to fail, because I don't believe in the word failure. You're giving yourself the latitude to learn. I've learned most things I know how to do well, probably by screwing it up the first time. But I guess the thing I've probably learned more than anything else is self-fulfillment is the most important thing of all. Being happy with what you do, feeling good about what you're doing, is probably the great secret to life. You don't measure a person's success by what they take out of life. You measure a person's success by what they leave behind.
There's one other lesson he learned along the way in the years after West Point. He laid it out in a talk he gave to students at the Academy of Achievement in 1991. Here's the part that many of them say they still remember decades later. Rule 13.
I had a great boss one time. I was his deputy. And every time he'd go out of town, as he'd walk out the door, he'd say to me, Rule 13's in effect. One day I thought I'd better ask him what Rule 13 was. And he said, Rule 13 is very simple. He said, when in command, take charge. Not a bad rule. But believe me, that is an overwhelming thought. All of the great leaders I have ever known in my life, all of the great leaders of history have had a certain characteristic. And that is the characteristic that they were willing to take the responsibility. Think back, you all, to the planning of the homecoming dance. Think back to the planning of the yearbook in your school. You know, there's hundreds of people literally that stand up and have brilliant ideas, and they're willing to voice those ideas and tell everybody exactly how things should happen. But when it comes to the doing, when it comes to the people who must make it happen, there are not very many that step forward and say, I'll do it. So that's the first thing I'd tell you. Remember that leaders seek responsibility, and they take that responsibility because they are confident of their competence. You must be competent to be a leader. Continue seeking competence. Competence for any role that you might take in life. That same boss, when I found out what Rule 13 was, I went to him one day and I said, you know, while you're gone, there's probably going to be a lot of things come up, and I need your guidance on what I should do. What should I do? What decision should I make while you're gone? He said, Rule 14. Naturally, I asked him what Rule 14 was. And his answer was very simple and probably one of the most profound statements I have heard in my entire life, and it's one that I would pass on to you if you truly want to be leaders. He said, do what's right. Do what's right.
But, General Schwarzkopf flagged, nobody is going to tell you what's right. By the time you're in a position to exercise leadership, he told Gail Eichenthal, you've got to have it in your bones.
Did you ever try to make a speech about a subject you didn't believe in? It's a lousy speech. I can't make a good speech about something I don't believe in. I've tried. And it's wooden. It comes out. It's not me. You got to believe in what you're doing. If you don't believe in what you're doing, you're not going to do it well. You truly have to believe in it. You have to believe that you're doing what's right. And I don't think I could go to war. I mean, I don't think ultimately I could serve my country if I thought we were doing something wrong. You know, I think I would get out. I would leave. So you don't have to stay. You have an alternative. It's not like the German generals who tried to justify what they did at the Nuremberg trials by saying, I was only doing my duty. That's not right. Because you have higher duties. You have higher duties. You have, you have a duty to your moral code, whatever it might be.
Did that gut feeling of what's right ever take you in a kind of a surprising direction? Did it cause you to change direction? Do you sometimes choose that gut instinct over what might be rational or intellectually right?
Oh, there's a lot of gut instinct that comes into everything you do as a leader. Leadership is an art. It is not a science. It cannot be reduced down to a piece of paper and a bunch of very simple mechanical equations that you'd apply to it and plop out the end, drops the answer, and you just go out and do that. That's not what it's about. So much of it is gut feeling. You have to have confidence in yourself. You have to have confidence in your training. I mean, you get nothing for nothing. You know, it really is, you've got, it's hard work. But you got to work hard so that when that time comes when you got to make the tough decision, you're also able to make the decision. Because nothing is more debilitating to an organization than the leader who won't make a decision. So you see Rule 13 again. When placed in command, you must take charge. You got to make a decision.
Well, all of the hard work, the confidence, the sense of what's right, the willingness to take charge and responsibility, it all came together for H. Norman Schwarzkopf in 1991.
Regrettably, the noon deadline passed without the agreement of the government of Iraq to meet demands of United Nations Security Council Resolution 660, as set forth in the specific terms spelled out by the coalition, to withdraw unconditionally from Kuwait. To the contrary, what we have seen is a redoubling of Saddam Hussein's efforts to destroy completely Kuwait and its people. I have therefore directed General Norman Schwarzkopf, in conjunction with coalition forces, to use all forces available, including ground forces, to eject the Iraqi army from Kuwait.
General Schwarzkopf was given the task. With 39 countries signed on, it would be a massive job of planning and coordination and diplomacy. 700,000 coalition troops. Luckily, he'd been thinking through that operation in his head for a good long while.
I was the commander-in-chief of Central Command then. I'd been the commander-in-chief of Central Command for almost two years when the war broke out. And my responsibilities were to conduct any military operations that took place basically in the Horn of Africa, the Middle East, and Southwest Asia. So, you could call it a lucky guess, maybe. But I had studied the area, and we had come to the conclusion that the worst case scenario that we would have to face would be Iraq. I mean, Iraq had the fourth largest army in the world at that time. They had just won major victories against the Iranians. They had modern military equipment, and so when you looked around at the area and said, you know, who is the worst enemy that you'd have to fight over there? It was Iraq. And we said, well, what's the worst thing they could do? And that would be sweeping down, you know, and deciding to take over all the oil fields. And so we decided that if that's the worst case scenario, then make sure that we plan to handle the worst case scenario. We can handle any lesser scenarios that might come up. So you might say we made a lucky guess and we were right. it was very simple. I had studied the Iraqis in great detail in their battles against the Iranians. And so I knew what their strengths and weaknesses were. I also knew the forces I had under my command, and I knew what their strengths and weaknesses were. And so what I did was I adopted a campaign plan that capitalized on using our strengths against their weaknesses and avoided their strengths and avoided our weaknesses. And that's a pretty good strategy for any kind of business you're in. You know, I mean, it's, let me give you a good example. I knew that our Air Force was much better than theirs. So I devised a strategy that relied heavily on us conducting an aggressive air campaign because I knew we could take their air out. I knew that they routinely fought during the daytime and resupplied at night. But we fight better at night than we do in the daytime. So I knew I could take the night away from the enemy and totally disrupt the way they normally resupply themselves and put them in a position where eventually they were going to run out of supplies and they're going to run out of ammunition and everything else because we just took the night away from them. So that's what it was. Use your strengths against their weaknesses.
Schwarzkopf's plan was to destroy Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war before a ground campaign was launched. They went after Iraq's tanks and bridges and artillery, all the things that might hurt them on the battlefield. The Iraqi forces suffered mass casualties, and there were reportedly mass defections. It all worked exactly according to plan. I don't want to imply that everything was just honky-dory, though. There was the sector of the American public critical of our military involvement, and there were accusations that the press trying to cover the war was being tightly controlled. I found General Schwarzkopf's discussion of this point fascinating, a reminder of the media's massive transformation in our time.
There was not control of the press. That's a word I violently disagree with. Nobody controlled the press over there at all. That's an argument that is argued in all of the wrong arenas. It is not a problem of the military versus the media. Don't forget, the people in your military take their oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's who we take our oath to. And most of the people I know of in the military are constitutionalists from the word go, and that's all the Constitution to include the First Amendment. You have a management problem. It's a management problem that is growing by leaps and bounds, both numerically and technologically. Let me give you an example. The average number of reporters you had in Vietnam at any given time was 50. During the Tet Offensive, the most important battle probably fought during Vietnam, you had 80 reporters in country. I can assure you all of them were not out with the troops, because those of us who were in cities like Saigon saw plenty of them back there. In the Gulf, you had 2,060. Okay. Secondly, okay, in Vietnam, when somebody saw a battle, it was generally reported and it would end up on television perhaps 36 hours later. In the Gulf, people could report things and they instantaneously out over international airwaves via satellite. And that was being piped directly into the enemy headquarters. So you had people who were reporting things that aided the enemy, that helped them. Okay, that helped them. And so there had to be some guidelines put out that said, look, these are things you don't report. Nobody did anything in the Gulf because they didn't like the press. Nobody did anything in the Gulf because they were trying to control the news story. So that's why I bristle at the word controlled. It sounds like there was some preconceived plot somehow against the media. Matter of fact, we were charged with that. Some people said that at the beginning of the war, there was a secret meeting held in the basement of the Pentagon where we decided how the press was going to be manipulated and controlled. That's absolutely not true. Never happened. What we were doing is just using our common sense, and our objective primarily was to make absolutely sure that the enemy didn't get his hands on information that would aid and abet him and eventually cost the lives of our forces.
There's certainly no denying that the casualty count on the coalition side was low during the Gulf War. Fewer than 600 men and women died, 383 of them Americans. When our interviewer asked General Schwarzkopf to describe the moments from the war that stood out for him, he told two anecdotes, and both had to do with the well-being of the troops serving under him.
Probably the one that I'll remember more than anything else is on the second day of the ground war when one of my corps commanders called me up, Gary Luck, and to give me a report. And I said, how you doing? And he said, sir, we accomplished all of our objectives yesterday. This was about 10 o'clock in the morning. We've already accomplished all of our objectives today. We're way beyond what we should have accomplished, and we have captured over 1,300 of the enemy. Then he kind of stopped, and I said, okay, Gary, now give me the bad news, you know, meaning casualty count. He said, we have one wounded in action. It was only then that, you began to realize that. But another moment I can remember when we sent that initial wave of aircraft into Iraq, we expected much higher casualties. And my Air Force commander, Chuck Corner, kept calling me back saying, sir, they've all come back. They've all come back. They're all coming back. I mean, that was another, just to, one of those, the recognition that you weren't taking these casualties that you expected, that they were much lower than that. Those are the two moments I'll probably remember more than any others.
And back in 1992, when he had this conversation with the Academy of Achievement, was he disappointed that Saddam Hussein was left in power at the conclusion of the war? No.
Now, from a purely personal emotional standpoint, sure, I'd love it, if he weren't there. But he's irrelevant. If you were to ask me, one of the few mistakes we made in this war, it was to so personalize the war in the form of a guy named Saddam Hussein. Okay. That now some people are looking at and saying, well, gee, we really didn't win because Saddam Hussein is still alive. That's not true at all. I mean, it was a great victory because we did accomplish not only our military objectives, but our strategic objectives. And what's more important, today, right now, we have the greatest opportunity for peace in the Middle East we've had in my lifetime, my entire lifetime. I mean, talks are ongoing right now between the Israelis and the Arabs and the Palestinians. You've just seen an incredible outcome in an election in Israel that's going to affect the peace process. And the peace process is ongoing, and all of that is a direct result of the outcome of the Gulf War. It's a direct result of the fact that Iraq is no longer a player over there. They become irrelevant in the politics of the Middle East, and that's important to the world.
After the talk I played a few minutes ago about Rules 13 and 14, a high school student in the audience came to the mic to ask a question about leaving Saddam in power. I want to play that exchange now because, again, there's nothing like the perspective of hindsight.
General, before I actually ask my question, I just want to thank you very much and the armed forces of the country for saving me from my worst fear, which is traveling halfway around the world to fight a war. So thank you very much for that. But my actual question is, General Schwarzkopf, at the end of the war, after that 100 hours, we've heard a lot of controversy as to what happened between the political leadership and military leadership of the country. Could you clarify exactly what happened? And is your opinion now that things have come out as to the fact that Saddam Hussein still has much more chemical and nuclear capability than we thought? Should we have gone on to Baghdad?
Let me see how we can handle this. That's a long question for the minute and a half they've let me have. Let me start by saying there really wasn't any controversy with regard to the end of the war. The only question was on timing, and it wasn't really a controversy. It was just a question. When should we stop it? I personally think that the correct decision was made. Not only that, but more importantly, my subordinate commanders think the correct decision was made, and an awful lot of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines that were out there think the correct decision was made, too. We'd accomplished our military objectives. We had also accomplished what the United Nations resolutions had told us to accomplish, and that was ejecting Iraq from Kuwait. The only question then was how much longer did we go on with the destruction of the Iraqi armed forces? Most of my commanders, I would tell you right now, felt that we had come to the point where it was no longer a fight. It was rapidly reaching the point where it was just wanton destruction. Now, let me clarify that before anybody walks out and has the wrong idea. We've got magnificent fighting men and women in our armed forces today. And one of the things that the commanders that worked under me were proudest of is when we finally got to that situation where the enemy was in complete rout and we could have literally gone in and destroyed and killed and maimed many, many, many people, the young men and women out there deliberately chose not to do that. Those people that were obviously had quit fighting, those people that obviously had laid down their arms, those people that obviously didn't want anything more about the enemy were bypassed. It was the only ones, the ones that continued to fight, that our troops were going after. So So the bottom line is we'd accomplished our objectives, and whether we went on for 12 hours, 24 more hours, was totally irrelevant with that regard. Now, the next point is there's been an attempt to make a linkage between that and what happened with the Kurds and what happened with the Shias. I don't agree with that at all. Over 50% of Iraq's armed forces were still inside Iraq. The people that we destroyed, in fact destroyed, within Kuwait, the 42 divisions that we destroyed within Kuwait were in fact destroyed. They were not a major factor in what happened inside Iraq. The only way we could have in any way prevented, if there is such a word, prevented the attack on the Kurds and the attack on the Shias would have been literally to do what you say, invade Iraq, go all the way to Baghdad, take over the entire country. I don't think there's anybody, no one in this entire country nor in the world who at that time was sanctioning us to do that. I also think it's very important to remember that the legitimacy for the coalition and what the coalition did was United Nations resolutions. If we had then gone on to take Baghdad, take Iraq, that would have really been a violation of international law. That would have been in itself an act of aggression compared to what it was we were allowed to do, legitimately do under international law according to the United Nations sanctions. Now, anybody could be a Monday morning quarterback and say, oh, sure, yeah, but if we had gone on to Iraq, a lot of that stuff may or may not have happened. That's true. A lot of it may or may not have happened. I'm not too sure, though, even to this day. As a matter of fact, I'm quite sure even to this day that it was not in the best interest of the world for the coalition to invade Iraq, to take over Iraq, to destroy that government, and to have ourselves in a position of being an occupying power in Iraq, trying to undo a great deal of things that are going on right now. Don't forget, it's not over. The sanctions are still in effect. The United Nations inspection teams are still very, very active. Just because Iraq at the present time is trying to prevent us from getting a good hard look at their nuclear equipment doesn't mean that they're going to succeed. And I think that everyone, the United Nations and the President of the United States, have made it very, very clear that that's unacceptable. So I guess somebody once said, it ain't over till it's over. And let's see what happens when it's over.
Wow. Talk about a time capsule. A decade later, of course, the United States would return to the Persian Gulf to fight a second war against Saddam Hussein and occupy Iraq. That war lasted nearly 9 years. General Schwarzkopf retired from the military, though, in 1991 and was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom that year. He wrote a best-selling memoir called It Doesn't Take a Hero, but mostly he led a private, quiet life in Tampa, Florida, until his death from the complications of pneumonia in 2012. He was 78 years old. There are many, many episodes of our podcast you can listen to find inspiration for your own life. Episodes about writers and business leaders, innovators and musicians. But if General Schwarzkopf particularly struck a chord, I'll point you to an episode featuring General Colin Powell, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during Norman Schwarzkopf's command of the First Gulf War. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Go to achievement.org for more information. What It Takes is funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for joining us.